cabbage stalk. Phoned to say that if indeed I was still interested, the position was mine. Something in his voice, hasty yet cagey, led me to think I had been selected from a candidate pool of one. That summer of 1998, I lived with Maddie in Morningside Heights. We subleased a studio on Broadway and spent 8 weeks doing very little other than exactly what we wanted to do, which is to say, a lot of drinking coffee, eating waffles, taking long walks around the reservoir or up and down Riverside Park, and reading magazines cover to cover in the bath. Never have I felt so free, so unfettered by obligation. Also, booing our time together was something of the thrill of a clandestine affair, for Maddie had not told her parents about our living together, and nor had I been altogether honest with mine. It seems foolish now that we should have felt unable to tell them, and so went on acting like children, even as we were chafed at being treated as such. It is not implausible to think that my parents would have been relieved to learn I was in love with a lapsed Catholic bound for medical school in New York. A Muslim girl would have been preferable, of course, but at least with Maddie, I was unlikely to join their only child halfway around the world anytime soon. As for Maddie's mother, the presumed objection seemed to be less on religious grounds than simply a preference for someone with a whiter-sounding name. Still, we persisted with our ruse. When my parents came to visit, Maddie's things went into a closet. When her mother and stepfather took the train down from Loudonville, Maddie entertained them in the apartment of an old high school friend who lived over on York. We left our landlord's name on the mailbox, his voice on the answering machine, and steadfastly ignored the landline whenever it rang. It was not until Labor Day of that year that I bought my first cell phone, a Motorola the size of a shoe, and which had to be held out the window to get a signal, if there was a signal to be got at all. We had dinner with the high school friend once. Maddie invited her over for pizza and wine, and the conversation wound its way to a point where our guest felt comfortable, asking whether I agreed religion stymies intellectual curiosity. On the contrary, I said, I consider seeking knowledge a religious obligation. After all, the first word received in the Quran is, read. And the third line is, read, because your Lord has taught you the pen.
He taught mankind what mankind did not yet know.
But religion, our guest insisted, with impressive confidence, allows you to ask only so many questions before you get to just because. You have to have faith. Well, I said, your problem with religion is virtually every faithless person's problem with religion, that it offers irreducible answers. But some questions in the end simply aren't empirically verifiable. Find me the empirical evidence as to whether you should derail the train and kill all 300 passengers if it would mean saving the life of the one person tied to the tracks. Or, is it true because I see it? Or do I see it because it's true? The whole point of faith is that irreducible answers don't bother the faithful. The faithful take comfort and even pride in the knowledge that they have the strength to make the irreducible answers sincerely their own, as difficult as that is to do. Everyone, irreligious people included, relies on irreducible answers every day. All religion really does is to be honest about this by giving the reliance a specific name, faith. It was not a flawless speech, tipsy and improvising as I was, but still I was glad the subject had been broached because it had seemed to me that a conversation along these lines had been looming on the horizon for me and Maddie for a while. Yet throughout dinner, Maddie was unusually quiet, and the topic did not come up again the following day. Nor did it come up again at all before Maddie started her pre-med conversion classes and I flew abroad. All those walks, all those hours tangled up in bed. Sometimes I wonder whether we hide lovers from others because it makes it easier to hide ourselves from ourselves. The Bioethics Council operated out of the basement of a Georgian townhouse in Bloomsbury's Bedford Square, a pretty oval garden popular at night with methadone addicts, whose regular discarded syringes were a regular feature of my walk to work. My aunt's flat was a pleasant place, four well-kept rooms in a handsome pre-war mansion block, but I did not spend much time there. Typically, I ran a bath, there was no showerhead, bought a coffee and a pastry from the cafe at the end of the road, put in my 8 hours at the Bioethics Council, and then read in a pub or watched a film at the Renoir before calling Maddie from bed. On the weekends, I ran. Not in the parks, which, with their manicured grass and mosaic flower beds, were too unreal. You got nowhere running around Inner Circle. Instead, I dodged shoppers and strollers all the way down Southampton Row, onto Kingsway, a right onto Aldwych, and over the Strand. Then it was a race with the shadows of the double-deckers crossing Waterloo Bridge, and a few bounces down the steps of South Bank to fall in with the ferries and barges, all of us purposefully gliding. I discovered in high school that I enjoyed running. Not around a track, but on my own in Shore Park, which in the early mornings afforded an ethereal view of Lower Manhattan, rising up like the Emerald City of Oz. I guess it would be more accurate to say I enjoyed running less than I enjoyed how running later made me feel. Still, there were immediate pleasures, namely the solitude and the sense of myself as a person in motion, even if I wasn't sure in what direction that motion might be. Had someone told me that at 22 I'd be living in London, having secured myself a respectable internship and a spot in medical school and a serious girlfriend back in New York, it would have seemed to me a fabulous and enviable achievement. But Bloomsbury I found deeply gloomy. When I ran, I would watch the indifferent pavement flowing under my feet and feel overwhelmed by the immense distance I put between myself and home. And although I liked the content of my work, I spent my weekdays editing newsletter articles on animal-to-human transplants, stem cell therapy, and genetically modified crops. The staff's median age was at least 15 years older than I, and after the onrush of college imperatives, this new learning curve felt too gentle, its revelations underwhelming, and its pace grindingly slow. Rather than fabulous and enviable, then, I felt in London the way you do when you take one step too many at the bottom of a flight of stairs, brought up short by the unexpected plateau and its dull, unyielding thud. The "Are you ready?" questionnaire that accompanied my application to volunteer at the local children's hospital threw into doubt a number of long-held presumptions. Are you emotionally mature and have the ability to deal with difficult situations and be sensitive? Are you a good listener? Are you reliable, trustworthy, motivated, receptive, and flexible? Are you able to accept guidance and remain calm under pressure? Are you able to communicate well with patients, families, and staff? This sheet of paper was succeeded by something called an Equal Opportunities Form, seeking confirmation of my gender, marital status, ethnicity, educational background, and disabilities, if any. It also presented me with a series of boxes to be checked depending on whether I considered myself low income, homeless, ex-offender, refugee asylum seeker, lone parent, and or other. I could not help but think it would be easier to dispense opportunities equally if one did not know the answers to these questions. I answered them anyway, of course, hesitating only when it came to low income, which certainly described my stipend from the Bioethics Council, but which I somehow understood to mean something else. For the interview, I got a haircut and bought a tie. A harried woman with a giraffe mural peering at me over her shoulder advised that the requisite police checks on my background could take up to 8 weeks. In actuality, they took 5, and my induction was scheduled for a Saturday that happened also to be Halloween. I call it an induction because that's what the harried woman said over the phone, but I'd hardly met her in the lobby and been shown to a playroom on the ground floor when she said that she had to attend to an emergency in the endocrinology ward, and we did not see each other again for the rest of the day. As I stood where she left me, charged with making myself useful as I saw fit, my first thought was that there was something sort of comical about having to pass 5 weeks of police checks in order to stand in a room full of children dressed as cats, clowns, princesses, bumblebees, ladybugs, pirates, superheroes, and yes, policemen. My second thought was that I had never felt so out of place in my life. The lighting appeared inordinately bright. The din of the children laughing and shrieking and meowing seemed several decibels higher than what I was used to at the Bioethics Council, never mind my aunt's sepulchral flat. The other volunteers, we all wore sunflower yellow t-shirts that read, "Here to Help," in blue across the back, sat on miniature chairs, their knees high like grasshoppers, or that most uncomfortable position for non-yoga practicing adults, cross-legged on the floor. Reluctantly, down I went, with pre-arthritic objections for my knees, and landed next to a Snow White absorbed in gluing glittered macaroni to a cardboard mask. "What's that?" I asked in a voice higher and tighter than my own. "A mask," the girl replied without looking up. I watched her work for a while and then turned my attention to Tiny Swashbuckler, who, with his eye patch parked high on his forehead, was busy stacking blocks. To him, I said nothing. These kids did not need me. Here to help might as well have been my own costume. In fact, as the afternoon wore on, I began to feel that I was the one being helped, and not least by this tireless demonstration of how very simple and egoless an existence can be. Put one block on top of another. Now another. Now another. Now knock them all down. Repeat. I was not of use to no one that day. About an hour before the end of my shift, a woman wearing an abaya appeared in the doorway holding the hand of a little girl. The girl looked about 7 or 8, and other than being a little on the thin side, healthy as they come, someone had drawn 6 whiskers on her face, but otherwise she did not have a costume, only a purple long-sleeved t-shirt and jeans that stopped a good inch above her frilly white socks. By this point I was leaning against a wall, my legs outstretched, while a couple of princesses, or ballerinas, one can't be sure, arranged and rearranged a Lilliputian gathering of stuffed animals around my ankles. The woman in the doorway stood watching for a long moment, then pointed in our direction and led the girl over. "Yana," she said, picking up a frog puppet. "Here." The girl took the frog, inserted a hand inside it, and sank to the floor. She had a striking face, smooth and boyish, with long eyelashes and a sleek black bob tucked neatly behind her ears. The whiskers looked like an indignity she could have done without. She held the frog in her lap, belly up, and at one point absentmindedly scratched her shoulder with its nose. Meanwhile, the princess ballerinas continued setting up for some sort of stuffed creatures convention. This involved lots of high-pitched ventriloquism and decidedly unballetic leaps over my legs and back again, the pink netting of their skirts rustling and jouncing with each unsteady jump. I thought maybe they hadn't noticed the new girl, until, unbidden, one of them picked up a rabbit, swiveled abruptly on her chubby pink legs, and held it out. "Want this?" The new girl shook her head. "This?" The other princess held up an owl. Again, the new girl shook her head. Then she removed her hand from the frog, pointed deep into the menagerie, and said a word so softly that none of us could hear. "Sun, maybe? Or sun?" "Sun!" I blurted. "Horse!" The girl nodded, then turned to look at me with surprise. One of the other girls tossed her the horse. Discarding the frog, the new girl took up the horse and, blushing a little, began to comb its mane of yarn with her fingers. I reached behind her for the frog puppet and wriggled my own hand inside it. "I wish I was a horse," I made the frog say in Arabic. The girl smiled. When the costumes came off, you saw the iniquity of illness more clearly. You saw its symptoms, or rather, the invisibility thereof, and you could not resist trying to predict the poor child's chances. An arm or a leg in a cast was not so bad. Often just a playground casualty that in 8 weeks would have already faded into family lore. A port wine stain covering half a face seemed much more unfair, although with time and lasers it too could be persuaded to fade. Harder to behold were the more structural disfigurements, like microtia, Latin for little ear, or Allier disease, a hyperproliferation of cartilage that could turn a hand as knobby and twisted as ginger root. I read about these and all manner of other disorders in the basement of the Bioethics Council, where a bookshelf jammed with medical dictionaries became my most reliable lunchtime companion. It wasn't always easy to arrive at a diagnosis. The doctors of the hospital did not readily share their conclusions, and, being a mere playtime volunteer, I generally did not feel in a position to ask. So I went on what I could see. Bulging joints, buckling legs, full body tremors. What you could see could be apprehended. Leukemia, on the other hand, or a brain tumor, even one as big as a tangerine. Their stealth was terrifying. It is not a logical theory. It is not even a theory. How can it be a theory when there are such blatant exceptions? Indisputably, there is no correlation between the visibility and severity of diseases. And yet the invisible ones have a special power. Maybe because they seem dishonest, disingenuous. A birthmark may be unfortunate, but at least it doesn't sneak up on you. So whenever I saw a new child coming through the lobby, I could not help but search hopefully for a sign of something tolerable, maybe even curable, like a sole that with a squirt of glue can be reattached to a shoe. Please,
Just don't let it be attacking her from the inside out.
Please don't let her have one of the invisible things. Practically speaking, I was doing this for professional reasons. To get a feel for the hospital setting and to work on my bedside manner. But in truth, I found it so emotionally draining that all I seemed to be working on was my desire for a beer. One Saturday, toward the end of my shift, a fellow volunteer called Lachlan suggested that I join him and some friends for a pint in a pub around the corner. Alistair was there, along with two or three others eager to explain to me the true significance of new labor, the inanity of cool Britannia, and the flatulence-inducing qualities of Young's Bitter. We also, that night or another night, talked about Afghanistan, or rather, Clinton's missile strikes of a few months before, which in the table's majority opinion were an all-too-convenient distraction from his so-called domestic problems. I doubted that. After all, Clinton had not ordered the embassy attacks in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi as well, and I kept one eye on Alistair as I said this, for I'd already understood that he was a shrewd and independent thinker, and I was anxious not to preclude myself from aligning with his opinion. But Alistair did not contribute much to this sort of talk. He sat in the corner, under a shelf of board games that cast a shadow over half his face, blearily surveying the far side of the room like someone involuntarily consigned to a long wait. Lit from above, the other half of him looked sallow and haggard beyond its years. And had I not known him, had I been there on my own observing him from a distance as he swallowed pint after pint, I would have taken him for a has-been, or a never-been. In any case, for a derelict alcoholic. To be fair, Alistair probably spent the first several of our evenings together taking me for a tedious newcomer. But of course, I was the tedious newcomer, and while Alistair may have been an alcoholic, he was not derelict. Not yet. One night, I asked him where he was from. Bournemouth, he replied, and then got up to go to the bathroom. Another night, the girl wiping our table asked me where I was from. Brooklyn.
But his parents grew up in Baghdad, Lachlan said.
Alistair leaned over the table to look at me with fresh interest.
Where in Baghdad?
Karada.
When did they leave?
76. Muslim?
I nodded.
Sunni or Shiite?
Caught in the volley, Lachlan got up to give me a seat, but it wasn't long after I'd slid over that it became apparent Alistair knew quite a bit more about contemporary Iraq than I did. I hadn't been in 10 years, and couldn't remember the name of the Shiite tribe my family belonged to. Moreover, when I admitted I'd never tasted sheep's head soup, he gave me a look of such incredulity, you'd think I was a man from Parma claiming never to have tasted ham. Still, a certain spirit of fellowship had been established, and soon, while the others carried on about cricket or the barmaid's backsides, Alistair was telling me about his various stints, not only in Baghdad, but in El Salvador, Rwanda, Bosnia, and Beirut. Where, while I'd been a teenager in Bay Ridge, alphabetizing my baseball cards and taking the PSATs, he'd been dodging Hezbollah and smoking hashish in the old Commodore Hotel. Stories such as these rendered me spellbound and even a little envious. I did not desire my own run-in with paramilitary extremists, of course, but I wouldn't have minded being able to say I dodged them. When I'd taken up drinking with the locals on Saturday nights, my Sunday runs gave way to entire days of Radio 4 and the quicksands of rumination in bed. It wasn't so much that I was hungover, although I did drink too much, and one morning, having awoken to the surreal cadences of the shipping forecast, thought for a moment I'd done irreversible damage to my brain. It was more than my new Saturday nights, quintessentially British and brimming with camaraderie, felt like whatever I'd been running to, which no longer needed to be found. The first Desert Island Discs castaway I ever heard was Joseph Rotblat, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate who'd helped to invent the atomic bomb, and then spent much of the rest of his life trying to undo the consequences. In his 90s now, he spoke urgently, with the Polish accent and the ragged rasp of age, and he described for the interviewer how, after Hiroshima, he'd vowed to change his life in two major ways. One was to redirect his research from nuclear reactions to medical operations. The other was to raise awareness of the potential dangers of science and make its practitioners more responsible for their work. His music selections, the 8 records he'd take with him if banished to a desert island, strayed little from these ideals. Kol Nidre, Last Night I Had the Strangest Dream, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, A rill will be a stream will be a flood, performed by the Swedish Physicians in Concert for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Your ambition, said Sue Lawley, when the Swedish physicians had faded out, goes beyond a nuclear weapons-free world. You want to see a world free of war. Do you believe that it will happen, or do you simply dream that it might? It must happen. I've got two objectives in my life, what's still left of it. The short-term objective and a long-term objective. The short-term objective is the elimination of nuclear weapons, and the long-term objective is the elimination of war. And the reason why I felt that one is important is because even if we eliminate nuclear weapons, we cannot disinvent them. Should there be a serious conflict in the future between great powers, they could be reintroduced. Moreover, and this comes back to the responsibility of scientists, certain other fields of science, particularly genetic engineering, could result in the development of another weapon of mass destruction, maybe more readily available than nuclear weapons. And therefore, the only way is to prevent war, so there would be no need at all. Any type of war. We have got to remove war as a recognized social institution. We have got to learn to sort out disputes without military confrontation. And do you believe there is a real chance of that happening? I believe we are already moving towards it. In my lifetime, I have seen the changes that have occurred in society. I've lived through two world wars. In both of these wars, France and Germany, for example, were mortal enemies. They killed each other off. Now, the idea of war between these two countries is quite inconceivable. And this applies to other nations in the European Union. This is an enormous revolution. People don't realize how big a change has occurred. We have to educate ourselves to the culture of peace, rather than the culture of violence in which we live now. In the words of Friedrich von Schiller, Alle Menschen werden Brüder. All men will be brothers. This, I hope, will be achieved. Before the interview concluded and the theme music with squawking seagulls resumed, Roplat also recounted how, in 1939, having accepted an invitation to study physics in Liverpool, he'd left his wife alone in Poland because his stipend was not sufficient to support them both. The following summer, after receiving a small raise, he returned to Warsaw to collect her, but Tola had come down with appendicitis and was unable to travel. So Roplat went back to England alone, expecting her to follow as soon as she was well. But 2 days after he arrived in England, Germany invaded Poland, and all means of contact between him and his wife were suspended. Only after several months did he manage to reach her with the assistance of the Red Cross and make plans to get her out through a friend in Denmark. Then Germany invaded Denmark. Now he tried through some friends in Belgium, and Belgium was invaded. Then he tried Italy, where one of his professors knew a willing convoy in Milan. But the day Tola set off to meet the liaison there, Mussolini declared war on Britain, and she was turned back at the Italian border. This was the last Rotblat heard of her. That evening, when I relayed this story to Maddie, she sounded distant and unmoved. When I pressed her, she remained silent for a moment and then cleared her throat and said something about how, once we know the end of an unfortunate story, it's tempting to ask why its protagonist did not do better to swerve his fate. "Or do you think it's all up to God?" she asked a moment later, in a voice that did not invite the affirmative. "God's decision? God's will?" "And if I did?" That I didn't see the end of me and Maddie coming seems impossible to me now. But at the time, I had this notion that even though my own feelings for my girlfriend had begun to cool not long after the spectacular prize of her was attained, to part ways on this basis would be as much of an act of infidelity toward myself. It unsettled me that the amour of a year ago could be so inconsistent with the amour of today, and I suppose that in my determination to pretend, at least that nothing had changed, that I was not so fickle and vain as to want a woman only until she had been won, I did not sufficiently entertain the possibility that Maddie herself was capable of changing, too. Then, on the last Sunday before Christmas, Sue Lawley announced her castaway that week to be the English comedian Bob Monkhouse. Amazed, I picked the phone and dialed the many digits that were Maddie, but there was no answer. Stormy weather started up, and I tried her again. Von Monroe, Racing with the Moon. Ravel, Barber's Adagio for Strings. During You've Cast Your Shadow in the Sea, performed by Monkhouse and Cass, I tried her a fourth time. My hangover compounded now by my bilious anxiety over why my girlfriend of 3.5 years was not answering her cell phone at 6:45 Eastern Standard Time on a Sunday morning. "What about your book?" Sulali asked. "That would be the complete works of Lewis Carroll." "What if you could only have one? One bit of Lewis Carroll?" "Well, Hunting of the Snark, I suppose, is my favorite piece of work by Lewis Carroll. But then again, I couldn't do without the characters in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. Now would it be, can I please have the complete Adventures of Alice?" I could see why she thought me hypocritical. On the face of it, it's paradoxical to be so cautious in life, so orderly and fastidious, while also claiming to place one's faith in the ultimate agency of God. Why give up cigarettes if he has already written you off in a bus accident next week? But theological predestination and free will are not necessarily incompatible. If God has a definite power over the whole of existence, one can imagine this power extending to his ability, whenever he wills, to replace any given destiny with another destiny. In other words, destiny is not definite, but indefinite, mutable by the deliberate actions of man himself. Allah will not change the condition of a people until they change what is in themselves. God has not predetermined the course of human history, but rather is aware of all its possible courses, and may alter the one we're on in accordance with our will and the balance of his universe. Or, as I put it to Maddie the week before, think of a bumper car's rink. Seated in a bumper car, you're free to steer yourself in any direction you like, while at the same time, your vehicle is connected by a pole to a ceiling that supplies energy to the car and ultimately limits its movements to those predetermined by a grid. Similarly, with his enormous bumper car's rink, God creates and presides over the possibility of human action, which humans then take it upon themselves to carry out. And in doing so, turning left or right, advancing or reversing, slamming into your neighbor or respectfully veering clear of them, we decide what we shall become and assume responsibility for these choices that define us. I could tell from the softening silence on the line that Maddie was not immediately opposed to what I was saying. But I could also tell, by the length of said silence, that diverging views on the scope of God's will were not really our problem. Our problem was a 49-year-old medical professor named Jeffrey Stubblebine. But never mind. We all disappeared down the rabbit hole now and again. Sometimes it can seem the only way to escape the boredom of the exigencies of your prior existence, the only way to press reset on the mess you've made of all that free will. Sometimes you just want someone else to take over for a while, to rein in a freedom that has become a little too free, too lonely, too lacking in structure, too exhaustingly autonomous. Sometimes we jump into the hole. Sometimes we allow ourselves to be pulled in. And sometimes, not entirely inadvertently, we trip. I'm not talking about coercion. Being pushed is another matter. In the little antechamber to the holding room, a large man wearing a fluorescent yellow vest tagged my luggage and swung it like a bag of feathers onto a shelf. A second man, less burly but only just, relieved me of my backpack and frisked me through my clothes. I was allowed to keep what cash I had in my pockets, $11.36 in stale American tender, but not my phone, because it had a camera. While we waited for Denise to fill out a new flurry of paperwork, the man whose hands I could feel still warmly palming my groin gestured amiably toward a vending machine. "Cup of tea?" "No thanks." "Banana? Cheese and pickle sandwich? Crisps?" These were arranged lemonade stand style on the table between us. I shook my head. "I'm fine." Denise handed me a new slip of paper. "In you go, then. Be quick as I can." The holding room was a large space, low-ceilinged and windowless, except for the window through which the guards watched us, and we watched the guards, with seating enough for 70 or 80 people. En route, I'd imagine I might be reunited with the young Chinese woman who'd flown halfway around the world at the questionable behest of Professor Ken. But in this moment, the only other person in residence was a tall black man, pacing agitatedly against the far wall. He was wearing a red-knit cap and a long cream dashiki as he moved back and forth between the convex mirror cameras. Suspended high in each corner, his cherry-topped reflection in them grew and shrank, grew and shrank. I sat down several seats away. A television bolted to the ceiling was tuned quietly to some sort of talk show. One woman was showing another woman how to make a Greek New Year's cake. This included an elaborate tutorial on where to hide the good luck coin, followed by how one should cut the cake so as to avoid what was referred to as a serious confrontation over coin ownership. After watching this dully for a while, I got up to read the notices taped to the walls. Pillows and blankets, as well as fire evacuation procedures, were offered in 11 languages. Next to a payphone were numbers for a refugee and migrant justice, as well as the Immigration Advisory Service, in English only. Also beside the phone were numbers for the airport chaplaincy and community ministers on call. The Reverend Jeremy Benfield, the Reverend Gerald T. Pritchard, Friar Oak Palaunka Chinello, Rabbi Shmuley Vogel, Sonesh Prakash Singh. Automatically my eyes scanned for an Arabic name. Muhammad Usman. Imam Muhammad Usman. Heathrow Community Muslim Center. 654 Bath Road. Cranford, Middlesex. TW59TN. A few feet away, on another folding table with a fake wooden grain, someone had arranged, giving equal prominence to each, a Hebrew Bible, a King James Bible, a Spanish Reina Valera, and two Qurans, English and Arabic. Affixed to the table beside the Qurans was a Qibla arrow, showing Mecca to be in roughly the same direction as the female toilet. Underneath the table, three prayer mats stood loosely rolled up in a basket like jumbo baguettes, while a respectful yet implicit distance away, someone had taped up another sign, this one also in English only. Sleeping on the floor is not allowed. The black man sat down and began rubbing his eyes with the heels of his hands. On his feet were dusty penny loafers, but no socks, and the skin around his ankles had turned the color of ash. The forecast for London that weekend had been temperatures barely above freezing, and for a fantastic moment I imagined this was why we had been detained, for lack of suitable footwear. After all, the NHS cannot be in the business of hospitalizing every underdressed guest for hypothermia or gangrene. No socks in December, sir? Very well then, take a seat. Just some general inquiries. Be quick as I can. On the other side of the room stood a second table, this one more carelessly strewn with secular materials. Newspapers in English, Spanish, French, and Chinese. A dog-eared copy of Japanese Vogue. Two French installments of Twilight. A Spanish romance novel. And a German edition of Eat, Pray, Love. I resigned myself to my earlier position in front of the television. The black man had gone back to his pacing. He was also making noises now. Short, intermittent, involuntary-sounding grunts and moans that reminded me of a pianist my brother likes. An eccentric who makes similar sounds when he plays, as though with the effort or ecstasy of his art. The book I'd held onto lay unopened in my lap. The hour of my reunion with Alistair at the Lamb came and went. The Greek New Year's cake was cut. Grozny was the worst. 25,000 civilians killed in 8 weeks. Dark winter days dodging shell holes and tripping over bodies tagged with martyr ribbons in Minutka Square. Some of the Chechens not already killed by the bombs were captured by Russian conscripts and herded into cellars, while in the streets their mothers wept and pleaded for their release. At night, Alistair and the other journalists slept 50 miles away in an appropriated kindergarten in Kazakhfurt, on tiny cots pushed together to make beds that were still too small. They held handkerchiefs to their noses against the stink of unwashed bodies in a room that remained decorated with children's drawings and watercolors. Bunnies and wizards, butterflies and unicorns, stick figure families holding hands under a rainbow pouring into a pot of gold, green grass on the bottom, the sky a firm stripe of blue along the top. You didn't dream, or remember dreaming. Trying to run under the plodding weight of a flak jacket all day was dream enough. Whereas the Chechenians, the Chechen fighters, seemed only too glad to die. And why shouldn't they be? A willingness to die is a powerful thing, especially when leveraged against those who would really rather not die. Starve me, humiliate me, raise my cities and take away my hope. And what do you expect? That I shouldn't be reduced to fighting you with my life? That I shouldn't want to be a martyr? The only distinction left me? You, weak man, sucker for Russian mothers and rainbows, go home to your English New York. to your party crackers and prefix with complimentary coup. We do not need your acknowledgement. We do not need you to bear witness. Your empathy lacks imagination. Even the Russians are better than you. Even the Russians are not too good to drink their champagne out of dented mess cups, blowing on their fingers and stomping their feet in the piss-riddled snow. For you, this is a novelty. For us, it is a cage. And then the world asks why. Why are they killing each other? Why can't they sort it out? Why do so many people have to die? But maybe a better question is, why do so many people not want to live? Some Saturdays, when the sun was shining, a few of us volunteers would take a couple of the sick children out to play in one of the public gardens nearby. My usual companion on such outings was Lachlan, a man of comfortable silences and exceptional trivia. One afternoon, we were sitting in Bloomsbury Square, keeping half an eye on our charges, when Lachlan pointed toward the iron railings on the far side of the park and said that the original ones had been dismantled and melted down for ammunition during the Second World War. These new ones were shorter and unlocked all day. Square's been open to the public ever since. I could not pass Bloomsbury Square after that without wondering where the old iron had wound up. On which fronts? In whose bodies? It was around this time that the avowal to do away with Saddam's weapons of mass destruction was accelerating towards its first anticlimax. Blair had declared it time to repay America for its help 60 years earlier, and pledged Britain's commitment to sniffing out all remaining stockpiles of genocidal intent. 48 hours later, Clinton announced that Iraq intended to cooperate. A month after that, UNESCOM reported that in fact Iraq was not cooperating, and lo, the British-American bombing began. I watched the Desert Fox airstrikes with Alistair, sitting in our usual spot in the Lamb, whose ceiling had been strung with Christmas bunting and the bar transformed into a lukewarm buffet of mince pies and a faux cauldron of brandy-spiked mulled wine. Throughout its broadcast of the Blitz, a final frenzy before the Allies would respectfully adjourn in honor of Ramadan, the BBC toggled between footage in two contrasting but equally mesmerizing palettes. One, dim and grainy, with palm trees silhouetted against sepia plumes and orange flares. The other, awash in the Maduri green of night vision. An explosion over the Tigris abruptly illuminated the water with the innocent quality of daylight. "Leave me alone," the river seemed to say, under the fleeting white glare. "I've done nothing to you. Leave me in peace." Also on television that night was an item about how the House of Representatives had voted to impeach Clinton on two counts. This time, when the sniggering about his foreign policy calendar started up, I said nothing. Beside me, Alistair too said little, and drank with a darker determination than usual. By then I'd begun to wonder whether, at some point in the previous decade, in Rwanda maybe, or Grozny, or perhaps so gradually that you could not pin it on any one abomination, the man had, as they say, lost his mind. He did not still seem to be without it. It was as if it had been taken away from him temporarily, for safekeeping, and then returned sometime later with a stern warning to use it for only innocuous thoughts. This, I imagined, was why he was there, watching things unfold from a pub in Bloomsbury rather than from the roof of some Baghdad hotel. I asked him why night vision was green. "Phosphor," Alistair replied. "They use green because the human eye can differentiate between more shades of green than any other color." "You could write a book," I said, a long moment later. Alistair inhaled and watched the foamy residue of his lager slide slowly down the inside of his glass. When an answer came to him, he looked relieved. It was not a real answer, but it would do. "There's an old saying," he said, "about how foreign journalists who travel to the Middle East and stay a week go home to write a book in which he presents a pat solution to all of its problems. If he stays a month, he writes a magazine or a newspaper article filled with ifs, buts, and on the other hands. If he stays a year, he writes nothing at all." "Well," I said, "you wouldn't necessarily have to solve anything." "No," said Alistair, picking up his glass. "And neither do you. That no live chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear arsenals were found that winter seemed only to fan the Manichean panic. Against this backdrop, melting park railings down into cannonballs and rifle shots seemed quaint to the point of inducing nostalgia. Certainly, as I sat in sunny Bloomsbury Square listening to the song thrushes tweeting overhead, it did not seem likely that the spires surrounding us now would ever be drafted into combat. Then again, had someone suggested that steering commercial airplanes into enemy skyscrapers might be an effective means of modern warfare, I suppose I would not have thought that very likely either. One day, a little boy with a bandage taped to one ear came over to ask if we had anything to eat. I gave him a hobnob. Raining crumbs from his mouth, the boy announced, "I'm eating a biscuit." "So you are," said Lachlan. "I love you," said the boy. "I love you too," said Lachlan. The boy watched the pigeons pecking the ground for a moment before turning to me. "I'm eating a biscuit," he said. "I see that," I replied. "I love you." I nodded. "I love you too." 3 or 4 times these lines were repeated to us. "I love you and I'm eating a biscuit." Until, having finished the hobnob, and perhaps having finished loving us as well, the boy ran back to the pigeons, who scattered lamely. Presently, my little Arabic-speaking friend came over, eyeing me slyly. I offered her a hobnob, which she declined. Turning to Lachlan, she said carefully, in English, "My daddy wants me to be a boy." "Say again?" "Baba says I'm a boy." Then abruptly, she turned on a heel and darted away. "Blimey," said Lachlan. "What was that?" "I have no idea. Do you know what's wrong with her?" Lachlan shook his head. "Only that she's younger than she looks." Sometime later, we would learn that the little girl had a rare form of something called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Normally, a stimulant called adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH, is produced by the pituitary gland and carried by blood drawn to the adrenal glands, which sit atop the kidneys. There, ACTH announces the need for cortisol, a steroidal hormone having many essential everyday functions. But cortisol doesn't come spontaneously into existence. It derives from precursors that enzymes convert into cortisol. In a body affected by CAH, the key enzyme is missing, causing the assembly line to break down just before cortisol is made. The result is a buildup of precursors, but never enough cortisol. And since it's the presence of cortisol that suppresses the dispatching of more ACTH, the pituitary gland sends out more and more ACTH, stimulating the adrenal glands such that they swell to an abnormal size. Cortisol is required for normal endocrine activity, regulating growth, metabolism, tissue function, sleep patterns, and mood. Untreated, a cortisol deficiency can be fatal, causing hypoglycemia, dehydration, weight loss, dizziness, low blood pressure, even cardiovascular collapse. Also problematic are the symptoms arising from the thwarted cortisol precursors, which include an excess of androgens, otherwise known as the male sex hormones. As a result, a 3-year-old boy affected by CAH could develop hair under his arms and acne as bad as his babysitter's. Likewise, a little girl with it could also exhibit masculine features from an early age. Body hair, a growth spurt, even a preference for trucks and tractors over teacups and dolls. When she reaches the normal age of puberty, her voice might deepen, her chest might remain flat, and she might menstruate very lightly, if at all. In theory, few cases should reach this stage of virilization, because earlier signs would have prompted a trip to the doctor, who in turn would have prescribed synthetic steroids to lower the androgen levels in the system. Sometimes, the problem is even apparent at birth. Instead of having a normal-sized clitoris, a baby having 2 X chromosomes might be born with an enlarged clitoris that looks like a tiny penis. Her urethra and vagina might have merged toward a single opening, and the labia may have fused entirely, resembling a scrotum. Yet an ultrasound will reveal that, inside, she has a perfectly normal uterus, fallopian tubes, ovaries, and a cervix. In fact, were she to have external reconstructive surgery, she would have everything she needs, save someone else's sperm, of course, in order one day to conceive. My little Arab friend had been born with ambiguous genitalia, but not so ambiguous that her parents, nor an obstetrician back in Syria, had seen fit at the time to call her anything but a girl. More recently, however, certain other signs, including the increasingly phallic anomaly between her legs, had raised eyebrows at home, and she was brought in. Indisputably, her cortisol levels needed to be regulated. But there remained the question of what to do about her gender. Her doctors were of the opinion that she should be given hormone replacement therapy, and perhaps also a genitoplasty and carry on as a girl. Her mother was inclined to agree. But her father had a different perspective. Where he was from, a boy is superior. A boy is prestige. A boy brings you pride. Where he was from, one might even say, better an infertile man than a fertile woman. In fact, said the father, I always thought she was a boy. It was a mistake from the beginning. She looks like a boy, she acts like a boy, her life would be so much easier if she were a boy. He's a boy. There's no cure for CAH. It's a genetic condition whereby the double helix inherits two copies of a faulty gene, one copy from each parent. Usually the gene is recessive to a dominant counterpart. But if both parents are carriers, there's a 25% chance their child will inherit both faulty genes and express the condition. This leaves a 50% chance the child will inherit only one faulty gene and become another carrier, and a 25% chance the child will inherit only normal genes and be unaffected. Owing to the probability that two parents will have inherited the same mutant gene from a common ancestor, autosomal recessive disorders are especially common among the offspring on consanguineous couples. The closer the relationship, the greater proportion of shared genes. The greater the proportion of shared genes, the greater the risk their offspring will be homozygous for the shared gene. In other words, autosomal recessive disorders are especially common in certain cultures in which, for enduring tribal reasons, to strengthen the family ties, maintain a woman's status within hierarchy, facilitate the finding of suitable partners, and preserve a family's traditions, values, property, and wealth, it is not only acceptable, but standard and even encouraged to marry your first cousin. In December of 2003, approximately 7 months after Bush declared his mission accomplished and the UN lifted a majority of its sanctions against Iraq, I saw my brother again for the first time in 13 years. I was living in West Hollywood, 3 semesters into my economics PhD, and I'd flown from LAX to Paris to Amman, at which point a driver was supposed to pick me up at the airport and take me to the hotel, where my parents, who had traveled from Bay Ridge, were waiting for me to meet them. From Amman, we would drive across the desert to Baghdad, a journey that would take some 10 hours. Before sanctions, and then the invasion, one could fly from Amman to Baghdad in less than 1 hour, such that reaching Amman meant you were almost there. Now it meant you were only about halfway there. When I got to the airport, there was no driver. Or rather, there were plenty of drivers, all of them keen for my custom, but none holding a sign bearing my name. At some point, I realized the address of the hotel in which my parents were staying was written in a notebook I'd left in the facing seat back of my flight to Charles de Gaulle. After about an hour, I gave up trying to find our arranged liaison, and via a series of leery interviews, identified a man willing to take me up to 5 different hotels for a flat fare of 250,000 dinars, or about $80. In the car, when this man heard that I was ultimately destined for Baghdad, he became delirious with ambition. I'll take you! I'll take you right now! Be there by morning! Quite possibly, this was an offer made with the intention of selling me to kidnappers in the desert. I thanked the man and explained politely that I wanted to rest a little in my hotel before continuing my journey. At this, the driver looked not only undaunted, but delighted. Yes, perfect. You rest, and I'll come back later and take you in the morning. He might as well have said, even better, I'll just make some arrangements to sell you in the desert, and then we'll be ready to go. My parents were at the 3rd hotel. When I approached the front desk, the receptionist was on the phone. After a moment, he placed the receiver on his shoulders and asked if a Mr. Ala Jafari and his wife were among his guests. And you are? Their son. The receptionist's eyebrows went up. He pointed at the receiver on his shoulder. This is your driver. He wants to know where you are. Where is he? I asked. At the airport, said the receptionist. No, I said, I've just come from the airport, and I swear it to you, he wasn't there. The receptionist nodded, inspecting me kindly, then returned the receiver to his ear and communicated my message into the phone. A muffled string of invective ensued, making both of us wince. Then the receptionist gave me another long look, as if he were listening to someone describe me, as one describes a wallet or a watch that has been lost. And as the voice on the other end continued to chew him out, he hung up. "You know what?" said the receptionist, shaking his head. "I know this guy. He wasn't there." When my mother opened the door, she was wearing a headscarf. Typically, she did not wear one in Bay Ridge, and for the first time, I thought the hard black oval around her face gave unflattering emphasis to her jowls. She had also, owing to her age, taken a walking at a slight forward angle, as if leaning in the right direction might preserve or even generate momentum. Lately, when I called home and spoke to my father, he would answer questions as to how he and my mother were doing with a report on how well or badly my mother had slept the night before. It was like a poltergeist, her insomnia and its effects, and my father warned me of its presence in the way he used to warn me approximately once a month that Fatima is not herself today. Now, in Amman, even as she beamed maternally on my arrival, I could tell that my mother needed sleep, and I hoped she'd be able to get some rest in the car. I hoped I'd be able to get some rest in the car. But shortly after we'd embraced, my father took me to one side and said that while it was all right for my mother to sleep, one of us would have to remain awake at all times. We were leaving in the middle of the night in order to reach Iraq around dawn. Moreover, day or night, most of the journey would be monotonous, mile after mile of scrubbed land and dunes. So it was equally important that we be on alert that our driver should not nod off, or, in my father's words, pull something funny. This was the same driver who'd been supposed to meet me at the airport and who greeted me now with an air of superior and charitably suppressed exasperation. His armored Chevy Suburban, with its tinted windows and long boxy rear, looked like a hearse. I could not have slept if I'd tried. Every uptake in speed made me start. Every pair of headlights advancing toward us seemed to push through the dark with an ominous stealth. Our driver gripped his steering wheel tightly with both hands, balancing his unoccupied knee and chewing his lip. He was a smoker, obviously. The car stank of it, and every spare compartment had been stuffed with cigarettes. Dozens of Marlboro boxes marked China duty-free wedged over the visors and into the pockets behind the seats. But before we'd set off, my father had asked if he wouldn't mind abstaining. Much of the first hour of our ride, I spent silently debating the pros and cons of this request. If our escort needed nicotine to deliver us safely into Baghdad, let him have it. We would not die of secondhand smoke in 10 hours. On the other hand, my father, who had only recently given up tobacco himself, had paid dearly for this service. $3,500. Why shouldn't he have his way? We arrived at the border a little before 4. Slowing, our driver opened the glove compartment and removed a billfold of American 20s, which, after powering down his window, he began peeling off and passing out to the Border Patrol officers as though they were the standard toll. "Any foreigners?" one of the officers asked in Arabic. Our driver shook his head. "All Iraqis." Now he was handing out Marlboros, 2 packets per officer. Then he powered the window back up, and it seemed we would be waved through until one of the officers standing in the road turned around and held up a hand. The window went back down, and 2 more packets of cigarettes were offered through and pocketed unceremoniously. Then the officer said something about Baghdad. Our driver nodded. The officer walked away. Sitting in one of the SUV's middle seats, I turned around to face my father inquiringly. My mother, with her dark eyes and snug headwear, looked like an owl. "What's happening?" "They want us to take someone to Baghdad." "An officer?" Our driver nodded. "An Iraqi intelligence officer?" Jiggling his legs, our driver ducked to peer under the rearview mirror and didn't answer. "What should we do?" asked my father. "Please," said the driver. "Pretend to sleep. Do not speak." "I have to go to the bathroom," my mother said quietly. "I am sorry," our driver said urgently, turning around to face us now. "We cannot stop unless he says to stop. You must be quiet. Your accent will discover you. I will try to take you quickly, quickly as possible, but please do not speak." By now, a large man with a beard and gray army fatigues was approaching. Our driver unlocked the SUV and the officer opened the passenger side door and sat down in front of me, causing the vehicle to cant. "Sabah al-khair," said the officer.
Sabah al-Nur, our driver replied. Good morning. We Jafari said nothing. Our driver relocked the Suburban, put it into gear, and resumed driving, waved off by the officers in the road. Our new passenger adjusted and readjusted his seat, reducing my own leg room by half. Then he reached up above the visor, removed a pack of Marlboros, peeled the cellophane away, drew out a cigarette, and did not stop smoking for the next 6 hours. My grandmother's house was smaller than I'd remembered it, whereas my brother was larger. Not fatter, not softer and wider as some of us became when we age, but bigger all over, in a solid and proportionate sort of way, as though to save space my mind had shrunk him down by 20%. He was also handsomer than I remembered, ruddier in the cheeks and readier with a smile, sprouting long lines around his eyes. When at last my parents and I entered our grandmother's living room, Sammy stood, put his hands on his hips, and grinned at me for a long moment, as if he knew my preconceptions were in the process of being dashed. And what had my preconceptions been? That he would be both more and less the Sammy I'd remembered? More boyish, less boyish, going a little gray behind the ears? He was going a little gray behind the ears, but this was less uncanny than the ways in which he seemed almost exactly the same. The squareness of his hairline, the singular shadows around his mouth. They unnerved me, these animated relics, but in an oddly pleasing sort of way. As it can be oddly pleasing to pass a stranger on the street and catch a whiff of your high school chemistry teacher's shampoo for the first time in 12 years. We think we have evolved. We think the dross of consciousness is shed. And then all it takes to splice in a frame from 1992 is a nose full of Prel. One afternoon we sat out in the garden, and while Sammy smoked a cigarette, he plucked an orange off the grass and tossed it to me for peeling. He'd graduated from medical school a few years earlier and was now a junior doctor at Al-Wasati, the hospital for corrective surgery. Prior to the war, the majority of his cases had been nose jobs, breast jobs, liposuction, and hip replacements. Now he spent his days staunching rocket wounds, tweezing shrapnel, and swaddling burns. There had been talk of the health ministry funding ear replacements for the men who'd had one or both of their own cut off for deserting Saddam's army in the 90s, and my brother seemed to look forward to this. After all, he said, if he were reconstructing ears instead of staunching rocket wounds, it would mean the fighting had died down a little. Wouldn't it? We were quiet for a while. And then I mentioned the little boy I'd known at the Children's Hospital in London, born with what looked like a butter bean for an ear. Putting his cigarette out in the grass, my brother responded wryly, I wish we had only nature's mistakes to fix. And yet he seemed almost serene. Not with the situation, of course, but with his choices in life. Certainly no one could accuse him of doing a job that did not matter. After the invasion, and despite the presence of overwhelmed American troops patrolling the city, Al-Wasati had been the only public hospital in Baghdad not plundered to the point of incapacitation. 9 months later, it was still undersupplied and understaffed, as an increasing number of doctors refused to make the commute into town or had fled the country altogether. The day my father and I went to see my brother at work, a drive that in peacetime would have taken 25 minutes, took us an hour and a half. Somewhere a tanker had exploded, bottlenecking traffic and burdening the hospital with a fresh influx of casualties. Outside the entrance, a man sobbed as the body of another was loaded onto a gurney. The sobbing man covered his face with his hands. Then he lifted his arm to the sky and cried, Why? Why? Why are they doing this? What do they want? Is it money? Why? Just inside the entrance, another gurney contained a child of about 10. His legs wrapped in blood-soaked gauze, and his eyes blinking with an otherworldly sort of resignation. No one appeared to be with him, and as my father and I waited to one side looking for Sammy, a doctor came over to us and pointed at the boy. Who is dealing with him? We don't know, my father replied. The doctor turned to the rest of the lobby and shouted into the rabble of people milling, weeping, praying. Who is dealing with him? Walid! Someone shouted back. While the doctor continued frowning at the child in a way that suggested only minimal satisfaction, a nurse led us off to the staff mess, where an Arabic soap opera was playing on a television in the corner,
and my brother presently appeared wearing scrubs. A young man who'd been hit by shrapnel the evening before was waiting for him in the operating theater. My father asked if we could watch. "This happened yesterday?" Sammy asked the man on the operating table.